Chapter 1. Digging a simple hole in the ground shouldn't cost so much. That's why the entire offer smelled fishy. But out of curiosity, and needing a job, a crew of 10 out-of-work coal mine tunnel diggers from Butte, Montana, answered a newspaper advertisement promising jackpot wages for a wintertime rush job in Miles City. Standing in a vacant warehouse, they waited for their mystery employer to show up. The door finally opened, and a slack, weathered old man stepped to the front of the group. He stood a shade under 6 feet tall, with a pronounced limp, and eyes that looked like they'd seen too much. He studied these rugged diggers for a moment. "I'm not going to ask for your names, and you're not going to know mine," he began. "I paid for your passage from Butte because you're all experienced diggers, and I'm in need of a tunnel. 200 feet long, with a set of rails to run the length, and a coal bucket car. I'll pay you each $1,000 to finish it in 60 days. That's a year's wages for most of you. And I'm not just blowing smoke." He tossed a hefty cloth bag to the nearest miner. The miner reached in and pulled out 10 stacks of greenbacks, bound into $1,000 bundles. His eyes fairly danced as he fanned through the stacks, then tossed it back satisfied. "Okay, you got our attention. So what's the hitch? Nobody pays this much for a tunnel." "I do. I'll pay you 10% now, another 40% when you're half done, and the rest when you're finished. Once you're paid, I never want to see your faces again. I expect you all to head straight back to Butte the day you're paid. We clear?" Nobody budged an inch. "Okay, any questions?" A husky brute stepped forward. "Yeah, just two. When do we start and where do we dig?" "You start tonight." "Where?" "Look at the floor you're standing on. You're going to rip up the floorboards and dig 12 feet straight down, then 200 feet due west." "Well, where do we haul all that dirt?" a second miner asked. "Here's how it's going to work. You're only going to dig at night, and you'll haul the dirt out the back door to freight wagons and dump it outside of town. If anybody asks what you're doing, you tell them you're digging a basement."
"Well, what are we really doing?"
"Maybe I'm looking for coal."
"You really think you're going to find any coal under this building?"
"You let me worry about that. Anything else?"
"Yeah. Stop talking and get out of the way. It's time for us to get dirty."
Mason and Thorne couldn't recall another winter as bitter as the winter of 1906. Blizzards roared across the northern plains in November. Temperatures dropped to minus 30 degrees in some places and hit minus 45 degrees the next month. Day after day, snow blanketed the earth, thawing, then refreezing, and piling itself higher and higher. By January, the drifts filled the deep ravines and coulees to near level. After one raging storm, Colson's Minnesota Avenue disappeared under a 9-foot wall, making it nearly impossible to cross the street. As flurries howled, a brave city worker lashed one end of a heavy rope to the street lamp in front of the Crystal Palace Saloon and tied the other end around his waist. Then, battling the blinding whiteout, he trudged through the rising drifts to fasten the other end of the rope to a street lamp on the opposite side. Once in place, that rope became the lifeline for anyone fool enough to risk it. One desperate rancher tempted fate during a brutal squall. He grabbed hold of the rope and inched his way along, as if he were performing a circus act. Near the halfway point, his leather gloves iced up and he lost his grip on the frosty rope. The winds carried him away, and his body was not found until the snow melted in the spring. During the worst of it, men hollowed out snow tunnels in the colossal drifts that buried the downtown area to permit resolute travelers to cross back and forth. Other than those token attempts, transportation ground to a halt. Trains sat idle. Even stout snow-busting locomotives could not muscle through the 20-foot snowdrifts that buried the tracks. For most folks, there was nothing to be done but hunker down and sit it out. Except for the cattle ranchers. Those old enough to recall the deadly winter of 1886 did what they could to prevent the repeat of the devastation to the cattle industry that fateful year. Old-timers dubbed 1886 the year of the Great Die-Up, in mocking contrast to the usual Great Round-Up each fall. That winter, the region endured 3 straight months of sub-zero conditions. Grazing cattle could find no shelter. They huddled together for warmth, but the vast grazing fields turned to tundra, and all drinking water froze to the point of bovine extinction. The starving wolves finished off the few hardy steers that managed to survive the ordeal. The warm Chinook winds in early 1887 thawed the land enough to reveal the deadly results. An estimated hundreds of thousands of cattle carcasses littered the land, many pushed up against wire fences or lining roads. Total losses went unreported, but in some areas, up to 90% of the herds were wiped out. Small ranches, what few existed, went out of business. Even some huge cattle companies declared bankruptcy. Thorn Hickam was 20 years old in 1886 when the great die-up occurred. He wrangled for one of those small spreads that got wiped out. The memory of Mother Nature's cruelty haunted him for years. Now a cattle rancher himself, and recently married to Amanda Walter, also a cattle rancher, he hounded his foreman Hank to do everything possible to protect their vast herds from overexposure. "What can I do?" Hank asked. "We got 10,000 head of cattle. I got no place to shelter them." "First you spread our winter hay out that we got stored up. Pile it up out there so they got something to eat. Cut our fencing wire so they can drift with the storm and maybe find some cover. Then have the boys chop down some of our timber. Drop 'em so that they pile up on top of each other. Then set 'em on fire. Do that in 100 places. Give 'em bonfires to try to stay warm. If we can just save half the herd, I'll be thankful." Christmas in Colson found U.S. Marshal C.J. Mason tossing a log into the living room hearth as his wife, Grace, wrapped a luscious lace crochet blanket, warming herself on the couch. A Christmas tree stood by the window, festooned with various ornaments and candy canes. Mason joined her with a hot buttered rum in his hand. For Christmas, they treated themselves to a brand new Edison Triumph B cylinder phonograph. It came with 6 cylinders, featuring popular singers of the time. Tonight they chose the Christmas cylinder, with songs from the Edison Male Quartet. "This is our first Christmas together," she smiled. Mason took a slow sip of rum and stared quietly at the dancing flames. "Never had a reason to celebrate the season till now," he said. "What did you used to do on Christmas?" she asked. "Usually just work so others could be home with their families. Used to just raise a glass with Jake Bass over at the Crystal Palace Saloon." He took another sip and kicked his leg up on the oak stool in front of the couch. "But I could get used to this." Grace stroked his cheek. "I loved Christmas when I was growing up. Father made it special with games and songs. The Christmas dinner took all day for Mother to prepare, but it was worth it. And after dinner we gathered round the fireplace, and Father always read A Visit from St. Nicholas. He liked to end the poem imitating the voice of St. Nick. Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." She sighed with a deep longing. "I wish he could be here. The weather is just too harsh." "We'll make a point to visit Grant in the spring," Mason offered. A silence settled over the room as their thoughts strayed. "You know, Mace," she said, "I'm going to be 41 in a few months. And you're going to be 42. "Yeah?" he asked. "Wouldn't it be nice if next Christmas we had a little baby boy to help us celebrate the season?" Mason made no reply. She knew he heard what she said, and he knew she expected a reply. "We just got married. Can we just let it be the two of us for a while? We get any older and we won't be parent age anymore. We'll be grandparent age." "Well, what's wrong with that?" "Don't you want a family?" "Well, of course I do. Just, does it have to be now?" "Now's the time, sweetheart." She wrapped her arms around Mason and held him close. The warmth of her love melted his anxiety. She held his head in her hands and kissed him. "Merry Christmas," she cooed. The day after Christmas, Tommy, the telegraph operator, stopped by Mason's office in the Federal Office Building. "Merry Christmas, Mr. Mason," he greeted Mason, sipping on a hot cup of coffee. "Same to you, Tommy," Mason said. "And why aren't you home?" "Well, a telegram came for you yesterday," Tommy said. "On Christmas Day?" Mason asked. "I know. Some people got no respect for the holidays," Tommy shrugged his shoulders. He handed Mason the telegram. "You don't got to read it now. Just thought I'd give it to you while I can. You can wait for a day or two before you open it." "Get on home," Mason said, holding the door open. Tommy bundled up and eased out the door to battle the cold. Once alone, Mason opened the telegram. It came from the Denver Mint. "Fourth quarter gold exchange postponed due to weather. Rescheduled for March. Expect a double load of cash to cover two quarters worth of purchases. Will advise you later on specific dates." Damn, he thought. The message left him with mixed feelings. Each month, all the gold mines in Montana redeemed their gold for cash at their local banks. Some gold mines delivered gold dust, others produced nuggets, while the more sophisticated operations melted their gold finds down into 9-ounce bars for uniform measurement, counting, and transport. By the end of the month, most of the banks found themselves cash poor and forced to redeem all their gold for cash to get ready for the next month's transactions. For eastern Montana, all the local banks delivered their purchased gold to the Miles City National Bank, where they exchanged gold for cash. The Miles City National Bank then waited once every quarter for the Denver Mint to purchase all of its gold stores for cash, which the Mint needed to produce gold coins. The Denver Mint just recently opened in February of 1906. In its first year, it produced 167 million coins, including $20 gold coins, $10 gold coins, $5 gold coins, and assorted denominations of silver coins. The exchange procedure followed a set routine established by the previous Montana U.S. Marshal, Ed Randolph. Each quarter, the Mint commissioned a specially outfitted train to make a trip to Miles City from Denver under heavy guard. The exact date of the arrival was a closely held secret to minimize the possibility of train robberies. Few people knew that the Mint train carried over $500,000 in cash for its quarterly gold purchase. The responsibility for overseeing security for this massive gold exchange now fell to C.J. Mason, the new U.S. Marshal for Montana. Mason's job required that he rendezvous with the train at the Warren, Montana train depot and take over escorting duties from the Wyoming U.S. Marshal's team. From there, the train made a nonstop run to Miles City, sidelining all passenger trains that might be coming the other way. Mason had never overseen one of these deliveries before, since he was only recently installed as the U.S. Marshal a few months ago. The fourth quarter exchange would have been his first. Now, due to weather, that delivery was postponed another 3 months. He felt some relief, since it gave him extra time to prepare, but also worried that the double load of cash made that train a more tempting target for criminals of all stripes, from hapless dunderheads to experienced gangs, all itching to score a big payday. Mason knew he had to anticipate all possibilities, and for that, he relied on the wisdom and experience of his faithful partner, Thorn Hickam. Shortly after New Year's, in 1907, Mason swapped out the wheels on his carriage for runners to glide over the snow-packed road and pointed his horse at the Lazy Y Ranch, the home of his good friend. Even with the sun out, the bitter cold required several layers of coats, gloves, and neck warmers. Mason bundled up for the 5-mile ride out to the ranch. He marveled at the work of Mother Nature. The blanket of white shimmered in the sun's rays, and the occasional white-tailed jackrabbit and the lone foraging mule deer reminded him of the gentle pace of life outside the city. The chimney smoke coming from the ranch house ahead told him he came at the right time. Thorn and Amanda greeted Mason at the front porch. "Ain't you a sight?" Thorn smiled. "What brings you out?" "Let's go inside," Mason smiled as he tipped his hat to Amanda. How about a fresh cup of steaming coffee? Amanda offered.
You read my mind, Mason replied, as he sat beside the roaring fireplace.
Amanda knew how her men liked their coffee, the same way they liked their women, hot and rich.
Thorne joined Mason near the fire as the three sipped their brew.
Thorne started the conversation in a neighborly way.
So, how do you like the snow?
I respect snow, Mason said.
Snowflakes may be the tiniest of little things, but look what a hell of a thing they do when they all stick together.
Thorne and Amanda had to agree.
Mason continued. Speaking of snow, how are things out here on the ranch?
We're doing all we can, but we won't know for sure if we're still in business till the snow melts come March.
Well, I wish you all the best, but let me get right to the point, Mason said. Then he looked Thorne straight in the eye.
I could sure use some help if you could cut yourself loose.
Help with what?
The quarterly gold exchange in Mile City. I just got word they're putting it off till March.
That means the Denver Mint will be sending a half a year's worth of cash on that gold train. Close to $1 million.
Thorne raised his eyebrows and gave out a low whistle.
Yeah, you get my point, Mason added.
I gotta raise a team to ride shotgun on that train, from Warren to Mile City and back.
Thorne gave a look to Amanda, then turned back to Mason.
I might could help you strategize, but I expect my hands will be full come March.
I'd sure feel a lot better if you were on that train with me, but I'll take whatever I can get. And I'll give whatever I can.
Can't ask for more. Why don't you two come over for dinner tomorrow night, and we'll talk about it.
Love to, Thorne said.
He gave Amanda a quick glance for confirmation. That seem okay to you, he asked.
Amanda smiled. We could use a little change of scenery, she said.
Mason rose to say his goodbyes.
Amanda, as always, you're a picture.
And you give your wife my best, Amanda offered in return.